morning, everyone. This is Tony Hutchison, VK5ZAI, your moderator for today. Coming to you from AJ to 2019, the 25th Australian Scout Jamboree, where 10,500 scouts and leaders are assembled for the 10-day event that will be in South Australia. Through the help of amateur radio on the International Space Station, or ARIS as we are known, a group of scouts will be speaking with astronaut and scout leader in the USA, Mike Fossum. His call sign is KF5AQG. The link up we made made available around the world via amateur radio. Helping us to achieve this today is Shane Lind, VK4KHZ, who will be streaming the audio live to the British Amateur Television site, and Bob Pittman, VK4DA, who will stream both EchoLink and IRLP networks, and the Bend FM, who will be broadcasting at the Jamboree site and online. Some of those that support ARIS are the American Radio Relay League, the Worldwide Amateur Satellite Corporation, and NASA. Today I would like to introduce to you and thank astronaut Mike Fossum for giving us his personal time to answer questions from a group of scouts at the 25th Australian Jamboree. Mike is a veteran of three space flights, and I believe he's done seven EVAs, or spacewalks, and is also the receiver of a NASA Exceptional Service Medal. Apart from Mike's service to NASA, he has scouting awards, including Distinguished Eagle Scout, Silver Beaver, and the Vigil Member of the Order of the Arrow. Welcome, Mike, and how long have you been involved in scouting? Over.
Welcome, Tony. It's great to be with you on the last day of the 25th Australian Jamboree. I've been involved with scouting. I started as a youth, and I've been involved with scouting most of my adult life, so I probably have about 50 years of involvement with scouting.
That's a remarkable achievement, Mike. And if you would stand by, and now I will ask the first scout to come up and ask his question. Stand by.
My name is Kapwa. Do you get to eat upside down? What do you eat, and how do you cook? Over.
You can eat upside down, because in space, when you're floating like that, there's really no up or down. It's kind of cool. Most of us kind of orient the same way, though, because it looks funny if somebody's standing on their head over the table. We eat a lot of food that's a lot like scout food, where you might have just add water, dehydrated food, add water, and wait 15 minutes for it to reconstitute, and you eat it. And we really cannot cook in space. We don't have a stove. All we can do is heat things up with a very gentle heat.
My name is Joshua. Do you use knots in space? And if so, what for? Over.
You do use knots in space, Joshua. Just like you would on the ground. If you want to hold something down, sometimes we use bungee cords, a stretchy cord with a hook on it, but sometimes we use a bit of cord and tie things. During my first space mission in 2006, I actually had to tie some knots on some equipment in the cargo bay during a spacewalk of the space shuttle. I tied what we call a clove hitch to hold some straps down, because they figured out too late that the little bits of Velcro might not be strong enough to take the re-entry, the trip back to Earth. And so it was quite exciting for me to be an Eagle Scout, a scout, a scoutmaster, and to be in the back of the space shuttle tying the same knots in space that I teach my youth on the ground. Over.
My name is Luca. What is something that is easy to do on Earth which is hard to do in space? Over.
Well, Luca, I would say probably the biggest thing that's easy on Earth that's hard to do in space is actually working on things. Because if you're taking a piece of equipment apart because you need to fix something, you might be removing some little bolts and covers and different components. In space, when I'm working maybe in my garage, I would take those and I would carefully put them in in place kind of in order to help me remember how to put it back together again. In space, they float around, and you don't have a good way. You can't just set them down or you'll lose them. And so we put them in a Ziploc bag, and at the end, when you're trying to put things back together, they're all swimming around in there. It's kind of like reaching into a goldfish bowl to grab one fish while the others are all darting away from you. So it takes a surprising amount of time to work on things up there in space, and at times frustrating. Over.
Hi, my name is Isaac. If you could go to space with any astronaut from history, who would it be and why? Over.
Oh, I can't just give you one. I would, of course, love to go to space with Alan Shepard, the first American to fly in space. I met him when I was young, but I certainly didn't get to work with him. A more contemporary astronaut would be John Young, who was he passed away recently, but he was a personal hero as he flew two times on the Gemini program. He flew an early Apollo mission. He walked on the moon. He flew the first space shuttle mission and then one more space shuttle mission. He was an amazing man. I got to work with him on the ground at NASA, and it would have been a real joy to actually fly with him. Over.
My name is Abigail. What risks are there to you and other astronauts on the ISS? Over.
Abigail, it is kind of a risky place to live on the ISS. In space, we have there's little bits of what we call orbital debris, leftover pieces like of rockets that exploded in space, and the little pieces are zipping around, and there are probably millions and millions of small pieces that hit the space station fairly regularly, but they're so small they don't do any damage. But there are bigger things up there that we have to be cautious of, and they are big enough to actually punch a hole in the space station that could be very serious. We also, the risk of a fire in the space station, and it's about the same volume inside as 12 buses, so it's a fairly large pressurized part of the space station. And but if you have a fire, you cannot just leave very easily. Once you get the fire put out and you have smoke, you can't just open the windows and doors to air it out. And so dealing with a fire would be very serious. Fortunately, we have not had these problems. Another risk that is actually more common, and we control it, is the radiation. When you're in space above most of the magnetic field, there's a magnetic field around the Earth that protects us on the surface from most of the dangers of space radiation. But when you're up at about 400 kilometers in space or 240 miles, 250 miles, you're exposed to more of that radiation. It's not a short-term problem, but it's more of a long-term problem where you actually get some damage to your body tissues from the radiation that increases your chances of getting a cancer someday later in your life. So we manage those things, we understand those things, and we train a lot for the kind of emergency situations on the space station so that when that alarm bell goes off, we are ready to respond and take the proper action. Over.
Hi, my name is Luke. Do Isaac Newton's three laws of physics that apply on Earth also apply in space? Over.
Oh, Isaac Newton was a very smart man. Is your name Isaac?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Very good. He was a very smart man, too, just like you. And the really neat thing to see was that, on Earth, you demonstrate Newton's laws of motion, and you always do it with the gravity always being part of it. When you're up there and you're in microgravity, you can see them actually even more clearly. You know, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So if you get going fast on the space station, it's very easy. You grab onto something and you kind of pull yourself along and you go flying through the space station. But all of that energy that's in your body, you know, you can get hurt when you if you hit something. We also got to demonstrate his first law, where an object in rest or uniform motion, how do you change it? You add some force. So we did a little experiment that we actually videoed when we were going to use the rocket on the space station to accelerate it a little bit to boost the orbit, to raise our orbit a little higher. The crew knew when that was going to happen, and so we had some cameras rolling, and we were floating in the middle of a module, and when the engines started pushing on the space station, you know, we were just floating in the module. We felt like we were motionless, but we were really going over 17,000 miles per hour. But we were going at the same speed as the space station around us, so it looked like we were stationary from where we could see. But as the space station started to speed up, we saw that as we were falling behind, as we started floating toward the back of the space station. It was so cool. Over.
My name is William. Despite all of your training, was there anything that you didn't expect living in space?
Well, William, I think that probably the biggest thing I didn't expect was how hard it was to keep track of your stuff, just your things, your clothes, your tools. Tools in particular, I mentioned taking things apart earlier, but you might be using a wrench, a specific wrench, and sometimes we only had one of them on the space station, and you wouldn't put it in a bag because you're kind of in a hurry, and so you would just let it go, and it's just floating there, and you can turn away from it for a moment and work on something and then go back and grab that wrench that's hanging there next to you. Well, sometimes I bumped the wrench, and I didn't know it, and it went floating away. And when you drop something on the ground, everybody naturally, when we drop something, when we think we drop something, we look at our feet. In space, it doesn't go down towards your feet. It can go in any direction. And it doesn't necessarily stop when it hits something. It might bounce around a bit until it sticks in a tangle of computer cables or eventually into an air vent. So they can't simulate that on the ground. And I had heard about it from other crew members, but it's just hard to imagine until you actually get up there. Over.
My name's Jasmine. What's your favorite pastime to keep you entertained on the space station? Over.
Oh, Jasmine, I loved being on the space station. My space shuttle missions were short, just 2 weeks long, and there was very little free time during there. On the space station, I did have free time. My favorite pastime, though, was really to look back at Earth. We have a remarkable cluster of windows on the bottom of the space station, and you can actually float down into the midst of those windows, so you're hanging kind of below the space station, looking out these windows at the remarkable planet going by. And I have to tell you that one of my favorite places on the Earth to look at was actually Australia. The beautiful geology of your country is just stunning, with all of the colors and the rocks and the countryside. And Australia is kind of unique because a large part of the country does not have a lot of vegetation. And so one of my pastimes was actually trying to take photographs of meteor craters that are in Australia. And so that was kind of fun for me. I also did low light photography, and just west of Australia, out in the Indian Ocean at night, we saw the Aurora Australis, or Southern Lights, And that was a stunning, rippling green river of light that was right below our altitude. And sometimes there was red aurora that actually stretched all the way up to 400 kilometers up to our altitude. And we'd actually fly through that part of it, which was a little scary at first. But I was practicing my low-light photography skills, and I captured a lot of that imagery, which is just so stunning. And I was excited to be able to share that with people when I came home. Over.
My name's Lily from the space station. Can you see natural disasters on Earth? Over.
Yes, Louisa. You can see natural disasters, and the biggest ones that we saw were hurricanes. And there was, while the time I was up there, we had three major hurricanes near the United States. One called Sandy was what they call kind of a monster hurricane. And I grew up on the Gulf Coast of Texas. I've been through a number of hurricanes on the ground. And I say it was just about as scary to see it from up top. I mean, it's an incredible white spinning mass of clouds with that defined eye that I was looking right down through the eye. And I was thinking about all of the people on the ground that were dealing with this storm as it was coming onto the shore. An interesting thing happened about 2 days later. The clouds had cleared. The storm had passed, but that area of the coast that the storm had hit, there were these great plumes of muddy brown water that were spilling out into the ocean. And so you could see the floodwaters going back out to sea. And you know that it's a bad day for, it's been a bad day for the people back home. I saw fires. There's many fires around the globe during the local summer. I did see fires in Australia. I saw fires in Africa, South America. And unfortunately, I saw fires in my home state of Texas, including a very dear park that I've always loved to take my scouts to every year. We went to a certain park, and I looked down one day as we're flying over Texas, and I saw a new plume of smoke coming from a new fire. And I called Mission Control and said, "Please tell me that's not Bastrop State Park." And they said, they told me, "Well, Mike, you nailed it. That Bastrop State Park started burning last night." So yes, you could see the natural disasters up there. You could see other things too, like deforestation in the, particularly in the Amazon rainforests. You could see where they cut a road and then people are cutting down the forest because now the road gives them access. And so they cut the forest to try to grow crops. And see places like Madagascar that are greatly deforested. And Madagascar, anytime it rains, it has plumes of the mud that show up out in the ocean. Over.
Hi, my name is Ben. What was your favorite part of scouting? And could you come to the next jamboree, please? Over.
Oh, Ben, I'd love to. My favorite part of scouting as a young boy was just camping. You know, we learned the skills in our weekly meetings. We'd camp just about every month. We'd go on a camp out. When I became an older scout, I loved doing what we call high adventure trips, where backpacking in the mountains or canoeing in a wilderness in Canada. Those would be typically 10-day trips, and I absolutely loved them. And are you inviting me to the 26th Australian Jamboree?
Yes, over.
I would love to attend. I can't promise you, but I would certainly love to come visit. I've seen your country, but only from above. I would love to come visit on the ground. Over.
My name is Kai. Can you see the Great Barrier Reef?
Ms. Kai, yes, you can. The Great Barrier Reef is stunning. It is just remarkable to see the reef and with the different shades of blue. around them. You see the huge structure of the reef as you're coming over, and it's just one of the most beautiful places in the world. A little bit similar to it is the in the Caribbean, is part of the Gulf of Mexico. It's there's some similar things. It doesn't quite have the reef structure, but it does have the a lot of structure that you can see under the water because it's fairly shallow. So again, when I had free time, I looked out the window and I tried to imagine all the beautiful places that I'd like to visit someday. Over.
My name's Samuel. Why did you want to become an astronaut? Over.
Well, Samuel, I grew up during the space age. I was born 2 months after the Russians launched the first human-made object into space, the Sputnik satellite. And so I grew up watching the early days of the space missions with the big big mission was to go to the moon. And I was actually a Boy Scout when we landed on the moon. And I remembered when I was about 12 years old, I was on a camp out. And the campfire had died down, and I was kind of laying on my back, looking up at a magnificent sky full of stars. And it suddenly hit me. I want to do that too. And that dream kind of became part of who I was. But it was a very improbable dream. I grew up fairly, middle class. My dad didn't go to university. My home was right on the Mexican border in Texas. So it was a very improbable kind of dream for somebody like me to have. But that dream kind of motivated me as I went on eventually to the university and into the Air Force and to the other things. I think why, for me, it's kind of, in a way, it's a sense of service to my country. It's also for the adventure. The same things that made me want to go backpacking in the Rocky Mountains or canoeing in the Canadian wilderness was they're a big adventure where you have to prepare, you have to be smart, you're going to endure some hardship, but you're going to see magnificent things and have incredible experiences, and that's kind of the 12-year-old boy in me that never grew up. Over.
My name is Zara. Space is silent, but what does it sound like inside the ISS?
Over. Hey, Zara, space is silent because there's no air out there to carry the sound, because the sound is a pressure waves in air. Inside the space station, we maintain the atmosphere at sea level pressure, and so there is plenty of sound inside the ISS. You hear computers humming. Probably the biggest sound is that of fans, because we have to keep the air moving in the space station. Right now, if you're in a still room and if you're breathing in a still room, when you exhale, your breath that you exhaled is warm, generally warmer than the air you're in, and so it rises away from your face. So when you bring in your next breath, you're getting some fresh air. In space, there's no buoyancy, so that warm air that you exhale that has less oxygen and more carbon dioxide in it just stays around your face. And so in a matter of minutes, you get a bad headache from too much carbon dioxide. And so all those fans are going all the time, and it makes it a bit noisy. It also got a little bit noisy in the afternoons, because I would always put on some rock and roll on the speakers in the space station just to keep my guys kind of keep upbeat and keep them working hard, keep them working at a fast pace. The other sounds were English and Russian. We spoke two languages on the space station, primarily, very rarely Japanese. And so there's often a chatter of for my Russian crewmates on the radio as they're talking to Moscow. Over.
My name is Nicola. How do you wash your hair in space? Over.
Nicola, washing your hair in space is one of the things that's easier than it is on the ground. Because without gravity, the water just clings to your hair. And so you can wash your hair without getting your shirt wet. What you do is you squirt a little bit of, you put some warm water in a little bag with a kind of a straw in it, and you can squeeze a little bit of that water gently into your hair, and then massage it a bit, add a little bit of shampoo, and you massage your hair. Now, what do? We didn't have showers. We used basically sponge bath or soapy water on a washcloth for my whole 6 months. But then now you've got soapy water in your hair, and I would take an old towel, and I would kind of soak up as much of that soapy water as I could, and then I would put some clean rinse water in there, and I would soak it back out again, and then I'd probably rinse it one more time so my scalp didn't itch. Over.
My name's Natasha. What do stars and planets look like when you're in space? Do the stars still sparkle? Over.
Natasha, I loved looking at the stars and planets when I'm in space. I've taught astronomy to scouts for many years, and so the stars are like some of my best friends. I know them like the back of my hand. The shocking thing when I got to space was it was almost hard to find the constellations that I knew, because there's so many millions more stars that are visible without the atmosphere and the dust and stuff kind of blocking the vision. The stars, if once you let yourself light adapt, you could actually see the colors, and that was really cool, because there's red stars and there's blue-white giants, and as you're looking, you start to see the difference in those stars. One disappointment was I was looking forward to seeing the moon close, and on my very first mission, as soon as I could, I was looking out the windows because I wanted to get that good look at the moon. And I was shocked. It didn't look any different. Well, what in the world? And then I stopped to think. The moon is about 230 miles from Earth, 230,000 miles from Earth. And we were only about 240 miles closer, and so it's trivial. So the moon looked pretty much exactly the same. The stars did not sparkle. That's because that sparkle you see is that starlight trying to work its way through the bits of dust and all that's in the atmosphere. So they were just shining bright and steady. Over.
Well, Mike, thanks very much for the great answers. And I would like to thank everyone, or ask everyone, I should say, to show their appreciation to Mike by saying, thank you, Mike, after three. One, two, three.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks very much, Mike. And is there anything you'd like to say to the scouts here and the general public who are listening in before you close?
Absolutely. For me, you know, scouting was the perfect preparation for being an astronaut. And I love the program. I still believe it's the best program we have for helping young people get ready for their place in the adult world. In scouting, I learned skills, starting with the simple and then the more advanced. My astronaut training did exactly the same thing. We learned leadership. I was the leader of my patrol of boys, you know, about six or eight guys when I was, a scout. And I learned about everything I needed to know about leadership in order to be the commander of the International Space Station when I was a Boy Scout patrol leader. There's also the leadership part of that. For me, it's rule number one is to take care of your team. Rule number two is when put in charge, take charge. And then rule number three is have fun while you're doing it. And we did that. It's a great, teamwork is so important to scouting. It's so important to being an astronaut. And it's really so important for anything you want to do in life. That same kind of practice and preparation, learning, building a team, helping lead a team. That's a skill for life. And I just want to say for all of the young scouts there, the boys, the girls, and even the adults. This was a very improbable journey for me to go to space. And I would say that no matter what your dream is, if you can dream it, you can achieve it. You have to plan a path and you have to work for it all the time. Mine didn't come easy. It took me 13 years of trying to be an astronaut before I was selected, but I made it. And 13 years of working, always trying to make myself better, always trying to prepare, and doing great at the other jobs that I had along the way. I've had a remarkable journey and have enjoyed it a lot. And I look forward to seeing, you know, more, some of you join us in space someday. Thank you very much, and congratulations on the last day of the 25th Australian Jamboree. I wish I was there with you, perhaps next time.
Thanks again, Mike, and on behalf of everyone at AJ 2019, I'd like to thank you for the very comprehensive answers that you gave, and also on behalf of the ARIS team and Kenneth, of course, I would like to thank you all very much, and wish you, Mike, and your family a very happy and successful 2019. Bye for now.
Good day. Thank you very much.